Well, good evening. It's good to see everybody again this evening. I've got my Bible open to John chapter 20, and I invite you to do the same thing this evening as we're going to continue our studies in being marooned, as has been our theme, the difficulties, the challenges that we have to our faith. Our faith is challenged in so many different ways, and we've looked at a number of different ways this week, and we're going to continue and conclude that this evening by looking at the challenge to believe. But before we do that this evening, let me say how great it is to be together once more. But this has certainly, from our perspective, been a very brief week, not just that it's a shorter meeting as we sometimes have a Sunday through Wednesday, but really it's just gone by very quickly, showing that we've really enjoyed it. And I speak on behalf of my family and I that this has just been a very encouraging week to all of us. We've enjoyed it. I always appreciate congregations that allow me to bring my family with me and accommodate them as well. That is such a blessing to me, and I hope it is a blessing as well to you. I think so many who have been out each and every night and being here, even when it is difficult. I know parents, it's difficult to bring children out sometimes. It's you've had a rough day, and it's hard to do one more thing, but you've seen as a priority to be here. And I also know that there are several who have had health issues who may not be able to be with us, but hopefully are live streaming, but others who have had health issues, but you've pushed through that, and you have been with us as well this week. That's very, very encouraging to me, and you've offered so much encouragement, and I certainly appreciate that. I also appreciate these teachers each night sacrificing and being able to teach their children and their classes, and I know that they are doing an excellent job at that as well. Appreciate the elders and their wisdom, their foresight to be able to have this meeting, this gospel meeting, this summer Bible studies this week. They've planned this for quite some time. I believe we were originally scheduled, I can't remember if it was last year or maybe the year before, to come, but it got delayed because of a certain pandemic that was going on. But we are finally made it here, and I appreciate that. And the elders invited me, not having ever heard me, so that's always a challenge to them, a risk that they take. They did so on the recommendation of Mike, which I can't believe he actually did. But Mike invited me to come, and I came on his recommendation, and then he left. And so I don't know what that means exactly, but if this gospel meeting is a success, all glory goes to God. If it is a failure, it's Mike's fault. So just let him know that. But we have appreciated everyone and their encouragement. We thank so much the Laws, Danny Law, that they had everybody over to eat on Sunday afternoon, the whole congregation getting together, as many as they could, and appreciate their hospitality, opening their home to that. And as Jeff mentioned a moment ago, allowing our children to come over this week and doing a little bit of fishing. They caught a couple of fish yesterday, and appreciate them doing that. Again, Danny taking our whole family out to eat today. We appreciate that so much. Appreciate getting to know Jeff and Marilyn Curtis this week. We had not known each other before Sunday. We had talked on the phone a couple of times and texted, but really enjoyed getting to know them. Very, very, very hospitable people. They have really sacrificed, and I mean that truly. They have given up their whole home. They left their home to us this past week, and it has been just like a vacation in many ways, an Airbnb, and we have been very comfortable, all of us, just been a perfect situation, and I know they sacrificed to do that. She would come over and cook for us, and it's not always easy to cook for nine people that you're not used to cooking for, and so those are a lot of mouths to feed, and not only was it just nourishing, it was wonderful. We enjoyed the food very much, and we know that came from their hearts, and that was the great thing of seeing them this week, seeing their hearts, and Jeff, in particular, as he works with this group, you can tell that he loves each and every one of you. He loves this group, and he loves God, and he loves his word. And I know that they will continue to do great things in the kingdom here in this location. So we've really come to appreciate them and hope that our relationship continues to grow even as we go from here. To God's glory, all of this. We do appreciate so much your inviting us here and us being able to grow with you in the Lord this week. So we have, as I mentioned, been looking at challenges to our faith. And our faith is often challenged, where we feel so alone out there in the world. So many different challenges that we face. Maybe the primary fundamental challenge that we have in the world today is the challenge to believe. You know, the world is trying to make it very difficult to believe in God, to believe that Jesus is the Son of God and that the Bible is indeed His Word. The existence of God is the most basic of all considerations in this world. Is there a God or is there not? That is the fundamental question that every single one of us must come to an answer for. If there is no God, then the Bible is worthless. Then Jesus Christ is a deceiver. That really our souls are not immortal, and that no one should be concerned at all about our actions. We might as well live it up for today, for we eat and drink today, for tomorrow we die. I mean, why even be here this evening if there is no God? And you can see why the motivation then is to try to deny that there is a God. Because if you can convince yourself that there is no God, then there is no consequences for your actions, and you can just do whatever you want to do to anyone else or to yourselves. And so that is why our society today wants to make it so there is no God. They desire that there is no God, and they certainly hope that when this life is over, there is no God. And they are trying to convince us of the same thing as well. In fact, it is no longer a consideration. It is assumed that there is no God. It is assumed that we evolved from nothing. If you watch any documentary, any science documentary, or read any book, they don't even question it as a theory. It is just assumed as fact. But if there is a God, our hope is not in vain. And man does have a purpose on this earth. If there is no God, we all have no purpose. There's no reason for us to be here. And does that even make sense that we are purpose-driven people? We are individuals who are created for hope. We are individuals, every one of us desires fulfillment. But if there is no fulfillment, if there is no hope, if there is no purpose, then why do we have that? Has that simply evolved? And if so, that makes no sense at all. But can reasonable people believe the things that are so crucial to the Christian faith? I would imagine that only Judas among the 12 apostles has been subjected to more critical and unkind judgments than Thomas. We know Thomas, of course, his nickname given to him in the scriptures, maybe by the apostles or maybe by others, maybe he grew up with it. His nickname, of course, was Didymus, which means in the Greek, twin. But we seem to better know him as Doubting Thomas. And the reason is because of his reaction to the first reports that were brought to him about Jesus being resurrected from the dead. He insisted that he would have to have hard proof in order to believe that it was so. The other 10 said to him that we have seen the Lord on that first day in which Jesus was resurrected. And they tell Thomas about this. But Thomas, one of the 12 in John chapter 20, verse 24, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. And the other disciples therefore were saying to him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I shall see in his hands the imprint of the nails, and put my finger into the place of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." And because of that statement, Thomas has been reproached across the centuries, which I think is an unfair thing. Because really what he is asking for is just what the other 10 already had, isn't it? They saw the nail marks. They were able to touch him. They saw Jesus. And even before that, they doubted whether he was really even resurrected when they were told about it. So Thomas is really no different than any of the rest of the apostles. And I would be the first among all people to speak up on Thomas' behalf. Because I believe that in Thomas' demand for proof, he is to be admired rather than ridiculed. In fact, look at what Jesus said just less than a week before this event. before Jesus dies in that final week, he is talking to his apostles about the destruction of Jerusalem that would eventually come by the Romans in 70 AD. In Matthew chapter 24, he warns them that there are going to be some people come along before the destruction of Jerusalem claiming to be the Christ. Verse 26 says, "If therefore they say to you, 'Behold, he's in the wilderness,' do not go forth. Or, 'Behold, he is in the inner rooms.'" Notice, "do not believe them." This was fresh on their minds, and Thomas has to be thinking to himself, okay, wait a minute, here is a guy that is evidently appearing to the rest of these 10, and he has come along saying, "I'm Jesus, I'm the Christ," and look at what they've already done. They're believing him, not me. I'm not going to do that. Unless I have proof, there's no way I am going to do this. And I want to tell you, there are too many people today who believe too much on the basis of too little. I am appalled at how much irrational garbage people are willing to swallow without a particle of evidence to back it up. People read horoscopes. They lay out their tarot cards. Used to be back in the day, they called the psychic hotlines. A few will even go follow David Koresh to Waco, giving their 12-year-old daughters over to him and proclaim him to be Jesus Christ come back again. And then, of course, in 1997, you'll remember Heaven's Gate cult, that 38 people followed their so-called spiritual leader and drinking a fatal cocktail in order to leave this earth and ride in a UFO following the Hellbop comet. Remember that? Into paradise. Call me Doubting Thomas, too, if you please. But I'm not about to believe any Dionne Warwick or David Koresh or Marshall Applewhite without some proof. Without some good, solid proof. Because too much is at stake for me to accept just any old claim that anyone makes if they come along and say, "I am the Christ." Jesus says, "Do not believe them." Not the least of things at stake is my intention to be a discerning and responsible human being. Even God's Word tells us in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, faith is the assurance of things hoped for. Notice, the conviction of things not seen. You may not see them, but you are convicted by them based upon evidence. God doesn't expect us to be gullible or naive. Now, I don't want to be such a radical skeptic that I set the standards of proof so high that they can never be met. There are some people who do that. There are some people who say, "I will not believe unless Jesus comes back to me and appears in my bedroom and tells me that I must believe this." That's not the kind of proof that I'm talking about. But neither do I want to be so gullible that any sort of alleged proof will count as a factual one. You know, fair and reasonable standards, however, ought to be imposed upon any proof that is offered for any point of view. Jesus here must not have been offended by Thomas' request, because he invited him to see the evidence that Thomas requested. Notice, as we pick up in verse 26, after 8 days again, his disciples were inside and Thomas with them this time. And Jesus came, the doors having been shut, and stood in their midst and said, "Peace with you." That was probably enough right there. Nothing else had to go any further, because they have the door shut and all of a sudden Jesus is there and he can recognize them and he says, "Peace to you, greetings." Then he said to Thomas, "Reach here into your finger and see my hands, and reach here your hand and put it in my side, and do not be unbelieving but believing." Now notice, remember, Jesus wasn't there before when he says, "Unless I do this, I won't believe." Jesus knew what he had requested, obviously. And so Thomas doesn't even have to say anything here. He just says, "Thomas, come here. I want you to see the evidence." And Thomas answered and said to him, one of the greatest statements in the scripture, "My Lord and my God." And there's no evidence here that he even had to touch Jesus or put his fingers or his hands into his side. Now, someone may say, "Well, there's my problem right there. If I could have that same experience that Thomas did, if I could touch God, I would believe in him. If I could just touch the risen Christ, I could accept the claims that all you Christians are making for your religion. But until I have that sort of evidence, well, I just won't believe." But that's where verse 29 comes in, where Jesus said to him, "Because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are those who did not see and yet believe." Now, the New American Standard here translates this as a question to Thomas. That's not necessarily the case in the original Greek. It may not be a question here. Instead, he might just be saying, "Because you have seen me, you have believed," which is the way it should go. But blessed and happy are those who don't see and yet still obey. Jesus said that we can believe in him as being the Christ without ever even having to touch him. And so in many ways, we have to be like Thomas, and in many ways, we can't be like Thomas. Like Thomas, it's good that we demand evidence for who Jesus is, not so much a doubter, but he wasn't gullible. Maybe we should call him the non-gullible Thomas instead of the doubting Thomas. And yet, we don't have the privilege of touching Jesus today, so we can't be like Thomas. Our evidence comes through other means. And so this evening, we are considering the challenge to believe, to have a faith that doesn't have to touch Jesus. Not a faith that's gullible, but instead, it is a faith that, like Thomas's, is based upon evidence, upon cold, hard facts. Now, here's the question as we start this evening. Can we prove that God exists? Well, certainly not in the same way that you and I might prove that a book weighs 2 pounds or that a truck out in the parking lot is the color blue. And the reason is because we can weigh a book and we can see on a scale how much it weighs, how much mass that it has. We can go out with our own eyes and visually see the color of an automobile. But the problem is with God is that he can't be seen, he can't be weighed, he has no mass, he cannot even be touched because he is not matter. We can't put him under a microscope, we can't see him through a telescope. You remember the first Russian cosmonauts who went into space, when they came back to Earth, they said there is no God because we did not see him out there. Well, that's not the way that it is. We can't prove God by any test of the human senses. But on the other hand, we certainly shouldn't believe anything without evidence. There are proofs of God's existence that we can call the fingerprints of God. Now, I'm sure you're aware that every human being has a unique swirl of lines on the tip of his fingerprint, on the tips of his fingers. A pattern that is found on the finger that is different from any other person on the face of this earth. And we leave minute traces of oil in these patterns of these swirls on everything that we touch with our fingerprints. And those fingerprints are proof where someone has been and where someone has touched. No two people in this world have the same fingerprints. And so in the courtroom, even if there is no eyewitness, the fingerprints that are left behind can be proof enough to prove whether or not a person is guilty. And even though no one saw a person at the scene of the crime, or maybe they did not hear anyone at the scene of the crime, they can be certain that you were there because your fingerprints were there. And in a similar fashion, I want to suggest to you that God has left his fingerprints all over this universe. In Romans chapter 1, you've studied this recently, I understand, but in Romans chapter 1, Paul starts out his book by saying the salvation is there for everyone who will believe, to the Jew and to the Gentile. But notice he goes on to say, here's the reason you need to be saved, is because the wrath of God has been revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. That's the reason you need to be saved, because you've sinned against God, and that brings about God's wrath, particularly upon the Gentiles. But he goes on to say in verse 19, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. The Gentiles can't say, well, we didn't know that there was a God. No, God made it evident to them. They don't have an excuse because the evidence, the fingerprints of God, are on everything in this universe. And what this passage tells us is that God's existence can be known through his creation. Now, this passage also goes on to teach us that some people have closed their eyes to this evidence, that they have begun to worship the creature rather than the creator. And so we need to realize that the fingerprints that point to God are sufficient to prove his existence, but they're not coercive. They can't make anybody believe in God. The fact that God has left his fingerprints clearly for everyone to see doesn't mean that everyone's going to accept his existence. The pagan world that Paul described didn't want to recognize God. But in doing so, Paul wants us to know they didn't have an excuse. The evidence were there. The fingerprints were there. So what I want us to do this evening with the time that we have left is I want us to look at some of the fingerprints that God has left us in this universe. Because things just don't happen. The very fact that we exist, the very fact that the universe exists, that it is here, proves that there is someone or something that has created this world. I want you to suppose that you are walking through the woods and you are enjoying nature. You're hearing the birds sing, the breeze in the air. It's a beautiful sunshine day like we've had the last several days. And as you're walking through the woods and seeing all these things, all of a sudden you come upon a clearing in the woods. And as you come to this clearing, you find what looks to be a campsite. There's a tent that is pitched. There's clothes hanging on the line. There's a campfire with food cooking over it, shoes beside it. There's even some s'mores and things like that that are all around that. How would you react to that? What would you conclude if you saw this campsite right in the middle of all this nature? It is in the nature of our human thought processes to assume that that site belongs to someone who was there before you even arrived. In fact, you might look around to find the person or the persons who maybe created this campsite. And you could decide that you're going to wait around to see if anybody comes. You might even yell out for someone, "Is anyone here?" And no one answers. Or you might simply go on your way. But I dare say that it wouldn't occur to you to say, "Well, how about that? What a stroke of luck. What a coincidence that I came upon this perfectly created site that is perfectly suited to all my needs." I doubt that you would walk in and claim this camp as your own and never entertain the possibility that you were encroaching upon anyone else's campsite. Never would it come to your mind to say, "Hey, how about that? This campsite just appeared. I mean, it looks like someone's been here, but that, we know that can't be the case. I've never seen anywhere in nature where a campsite just appears, but that had to be the conclusion here." When we see such things, we don't assume that they just happened. We know that someone had to set up that campsite, even if we don't see the person who did. And by investigating that campsite, looking at the clothes that are hanging on the line, looking at how much food is there, looking at the footprints that might be around the campsite, you might even have a good idea about the nature of that person, what he enjoys, what kind of food he wears. Based upon the clothes, you might say how tall he was or how many people were there in this campsite. And likewise, the Apostle Paul asserted that men and women have some knowledge of God simply by seeing the world that he has created. In Acts chapter 14, Paul and Barnabas come to the city of Lystra, and they heal a man who has been lame since birth. But when they do that, the men there in Lystra begin to worship Paul and Barnabas as if they are gods, Zeus and Hermes. And Paul stops them from doing this in verse 15. He says, "Men, why are you doing these things? We are also men of the same nature as you and preach the gospel to you in order that you should turn from these vain things, worshiping idols, to a living God, a real God who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. And in the generations gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways." But notice, "yet he did not leave himself without witness." Notice, without evidence. "In order that he did good, and he gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness." You know what Paul's saying here is, look, God has given you all kinds of evidence. He sent you all kinds of fingerprints, all kinds of messages to you saying, "I'm there." Every time it rained, every time you ate a meal, every time you looked around you and you saw these things. Sometimes this sort of reasoning is called natural theology. Theology is the study of God or thinking about God. And so natural theology results from reflections on the natural world in which we find ourselves. That we can look around at this world and we can know something about God. We can't know the complete picture without his revelation, understand? But don't want you to think about it. The universe in which we live, that we inhabit here, it either popped into existence from nothing or was called into existence by some eternal force that preexisted it.
Philosophers, even as early as Plato, have reasoned from nature to nature's creator. That is, from the habitable world to a world arranger. That living in this world proves that there is something who created it. And that's really the point I'm trying to make with this campsite analogy. We know that campsites just don't appear in forest clearings. Humans are generally too bright to accept it's just that sort of way, explanation for tents and coffee and s'mores and sleeping bags. But we humans have come upon this campsite in the middle of the cosmos. It is planet Earth. It is here, and it is habitable. And yet people says, well, it's just that way. And that statement might seem sufficient as an explanation initially, but the more that we think about it, the more we know that that's no explanation at all. And when the scientists come along and just say it's that way, most of society just accepts it. They know better than I do without even thinking about it rationally. And so we begin looking around for clues that might offer a reasonable account of why this clearing is here and why it has its particular form. In fact, we eventually realize that our own presence in this clearing is something that has to have an explanation. That is the same reasoning of the Hebrew writer in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now, in the context, he's not talking about evidences for God, but the principle is true here. Everything has to have a builder. If you drive home and you see a house, you knew it had to have a builder. We teach our children this from a very early age, don't we? Who made the trees? God. Who made the flowers? God. We do that with our children, don't we? I remember doing that with our first, she's married and is in Arizona. We used to say, Grace, who made the trees? God. Who made the house? God. We did all these things. Well, I came home from a Bible study one afternoon, and there was this huge mess on the floor. And the first thing I said to her is, who made this mess? She said, God. You know, you can't blame everything on him, okay? But we do know that everything goes back to that. Now, as our children get a little bit older, they start to reason. Now, wait a minute. I understand my toy came from the toy factory. What do you mean it came from God? Okay, yes, it came from the toy factory. But where did the toy factory come from? Well, men put it together. Well, where did those men come from? Well, they came from their parents. Well, their parents and their parents. You see, everything goes back to, finally, we got to ask, well, where did the original parents come from? Where did the original plastic come from and the chemicals come from to make the toys? Well, they just didn't come into existence. They must have come from something. And so we look around at the universe and the world in which we live, and we see the flowers and the trees and the dogs and the cats and the birds and all these things. Where did they come from? The very fact that something is here demands that someone put them here, that things just don't appear out of thin air. Where did man come from? Atheists tried to tell us that we evolved from monkeys. Monkeys came from lower mammal forms, and that mammals came from birds, and birds from reptiles, and reptiles from amphibians, and amphibians from fish, and fish from plants, and plants from bacteria, and bacteria from something smaller, chemicals of some sort. But where did they come from, all of those things? Where did those one-cell, single-cell amoebas come from? Even if they say they came from explosive gases, where did those explosive gases came from? If we were begun with a Big Bang, who set off the Big Bang to begin with? Where did the Big Bang come from? Whatever was in the beginning had to come from someone or something. And there's two possibilities. There's only two that exist that I know of. Either everything that we came from matter, or it came from mind. That's the only thing, two things that exist. Matter exists in this universe, and mind. That is, things that aren't tangible. Things like philosophy, things like love, things, ideas, things that we cannot touch or measure, but we know they exist. So the question is, where did everything come from? Did it come from matter, or did it come from mind? Either the materials in this universe have always existed and then evolved by chance into the world that we know today, or in the beginning there was an eternal, intelligent, powerful being who created this world. That is the only two possibilities. If matter is eternal, I want you to think about what that means. It means that somehow rocks and dirt and gases somehow change themselves to become living things. That's what's known in science as spontaneous generation. which every scientist denies occurs. There is no such thing as spontaneous generation, that nothing comes from nothing but nothingness. You can't have a living being come from something that is inorganic. Nobody changes them in their theory. They just happen to change over time. That plants grew arms and legs and heads and became animals. And granted, this is supposed to take place over millions and millions of years, but still that's what's supposed to happen. And animals change themselves to become thinking, intelligent, moral human beings. And if that is the case, there's really no difference between a human and a pile of dirt in my backyard, other than a billion years of such pure blind chance. And still, we don't know where that pile of dirt came from. The alternative is to believe that all things that exist owe their existence to the creation of a supreme being that is outside of nature. Because oftentimes people will say, well, if everything has to have a source, well, then where did God come from? You see, that rule that everything must come from something else only applies in this universe. It doesn't apply to things outside the universe like a creator would be. And so it only makes sense that there is something outside of this universe that exists, that spoke this world into being, a God who created the stars and the seas and the plants and the animals and set us in this place that we call planet Earth. There are no other choices. And believing either way requires a step of faith because nobody saw it happen. But it seems to me that the evidence weighs strongly in favor of an eternal God. The mere fact that you and I exist, I believe, is a fingerprint of God. Another fingerprint of God is the argument of design. That design points to a designer. Suppose I point to you a car that is four tires made of rubber and nylon and has steel bands connected to two axles and a steering column. On top, it has a steel body with four doors, glass in the windows, comfortable seats. It has a heater, air conditioner, FM, AM, radio, MP3 player, satellite. Under the hood, there's a six-cylinder engine. Outside, a beautiful paint job, chrome trim. And you ask me, well, where did this car come from? And I say to you, well, you know, most people think, because it has that Ford symbol at the front of it, that the Ford company, Ford Motor Company, built this car. But I have my own explanation for this. That nobody designed or manufactured this car. It just came out of the Bedford County garbage dump. And one night during this electrical storm, there were all these pieces of metal and plastic and rubber that at the same time were just hit by this lightning, and these molecules were changed and it was molded together. And in a billion to one chance, when this storm was over, this car was blown into my driveway, and now I have this car sitting there. Now, if I honestly believe that, you would be calling the men in the white coats to come and take me away. And yet, that's not a bit more unreasonable than the atheist who looks around and he says, this world is so, with its intricate design that we see, just happened to fall into place. The design of an automobile is nothing when compared to the universe. The design of this world is a fingerprint that points to God. In Psalm 19, David said in verse 1, the heavens are telling the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, there nor words. Their voice is not heard. It's as if creation is screaming out, look, God is there. The creation around points to God. And look at nature. What about the instincts that we read about, that we know of in animals? How is it that birds know how to make the same exact nest that their parents made for them? They weren't there to watch their parents. They don't see other birds do this. They don't go to school to learn how to build nests. They just know it. How does that happen? It doesn't just evolve, but yet a creator put it in their brains. How do fish know exactly where to go back to spawn from the very place where they were born the year before, going hundreds and hundreds of miles upstream in order to get to that exact same place? And look at the balance of nature, the flowers and birds. They need insects. Think about it. If flowers were around for millions of years before insects came, they would not have existed. because insects are necessary to reproduce for flowers to live. But if insects had evolved before the birds, they would have been covering the earth so much that there would have been nothing there to eat them. All of nature is in delicate balance that evolutionists just can't explain. And look at the human body. David also said in Psalm 139 and verse 14, I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. And we are just beginning to appreciate how much David was truthful about that. Our brains, no computer can do what one single brain cell can accomplish. Our respiratory system is amazing, where air and blood are able to exchange oxygen and carbon dioxide. How long do you think it would take for such a complex system within our body to evolve? If it took more than even 5 minutes, then everything would have died. Our eyes are so complex that even though inventors try, that the camera can't even do what our eyes can do. In fact, in a debate between Thomas Warren, who was an institutional preacher, and Dr. Anthony Flew, who is a well-known atheist, on the existence of God, Mr. Warren showed Dr. Flew two pictures. One was a picture of a human hand, the other a picture of a mechanical hand. And Dr. Flew said that he knew that the mechanical one had to have intelligence behind it because of its intricate design. He could tell that someone had designed that robotic hand. But he also knew that the ultimate source of the natural hand was a non-living material, like rocks and dust. I find that incredible, incredibly dishonest. You know, one of the most amazing designs to me in the whole universe is human birth. And let me share with you a beautiful design involving the human heart. The human heart, of course, you may know, is divided into four different chambers. And the two chambers on one side is to separate the blood from the two chambers on the other side, to separate the pure from the impure blood. And one side handles the blood after it receives oxygen from the lungs, and the other side handles the impure blood that's on its way back to the lungs. And if blood were to flow from one side to the other, we would die because we would not have enough oxygen in our bodies. But what's interesting is that in an unborn infant, the division between those different chambers there isn't necessary because it gets blood from its mother, and all of it is pure. And so there is this passage, this hole in the heart in an unborn infant, where blood can travel between one chamber, one side of the heart, to the other. And the moment that that child is born, there is a muscle that contracts in the heart, and it closes that opening. And that is the only time in our entire lives that that muscle is even used. Let me ask you a question. How many millions of years do you suppose it took for that muscle to evolve? Is that by chance, or is that by a designer? What I'm trying to say is that the universe is filled with intelligent design, and we could spend all night talking about these sort of things. Look at the stars and the earth and nature and even our own body. Each fragment is infinitely more complex than a car. You know, if you took the letters A to Z, 26 letters in our alphabet, you toss them in the air, the chances of them falling down in the right order from A to Z alphabetically are 500 quintillion to one. That's the chances. And if you can't understand that number, that's more than the national debt, okay? It is a five with 20 zeros behind it. That is a big number. And yet we look around us, and without God, we have to assume that the elements of the universe were simply tossed into space and they fell down into this order and design that we see all around us. And it's much more than just 26 elements. I don't know about you, but I find that too incredible to believe. A boy was once told by an atheist, I'll give you an apple if you can show me where God is. To which he responded, I will give you a bushel of apples if you show me where God is not. The design of this universe is the fingerprint of God. And the more we learn about this world, the stronger the evidence it is. As John said about Jesus, the Word, in John 1 and verse 3, all things came into being by him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. Everything in this world came into being through Jesus Christ. So where does the Bible fit into all of this?
we've certainly proven that there is a God who has created this world. But what about the Bible?
Well, going back to that encounter between Thomas and Jesus earlier that we read in our sermon this evening, do you remember how it ended? Thomas is invited to touch Jesus, and his doubts were banished. His faith begins to soar. He answered and he says, "My Lord and my God." And Jesus responds to that confession again, very interesting, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who did not see and yet believe." And then what John does, as the author, guided by the Holy Spirit in this book, he adds his own footnote following this. And this is the summary, by the way, of the book of John. He says, "Many other signs, therefore, Jesus performed in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing in him, you may have life in his name." People who have lived in generations following Jesus have to depend upon the scriptures as the basis of faith in him. And there is no book that's been subjected to a rigorous scrutiny of its friends and at the same time the contemptuous attacks from its enemies than the Bible. In fact, it was once quite fashionable to attack the Bible for its alleged anachronisms and its historical blunders and its scientific errors. But there's been a radical about-face in the last half of the 20th century, and that's largely due to the evidence that archaeology has been able to provide over in recent years, that no single science has done as much as archaeology to confirm the reliability of the Bible. In fact, archaeologists have discovered people and events and whole civilizations which were previously unknown to historians except for through the Old Testament. The Hittites, the Philistines, Sargon, the king of Assyria, and King Belshazzar of Babylon are people that the Bible said existed, and yet archaeologists, historians, and paleontologists believe that these people were not real because we don't read about anything of them in history. And yet, one by one, archaeology has confirmed the existence of each and one of them, just as the Bible has said. And the biblical story of King David was considered at once to be too fantastic to be anything other than a myth. King David must have been this made-up character, much like the legends of King Arthur. But in 1983, Israeli archaeologists unearthed a piece of stone from an ancient monument that was dated from the 9th century BC and inscribed in Aramaic were the words, "King of Israel and House of David." And the skeptical claim that King David never existed except for in fiction has been completely dropped. The Bible is anything but an archaic millstone around the necks of modern people. It is the rock-solid foundation on which our faith is built. It has withstood the test of time, and it has survived the violent attacks of unbelief. It is absolutely a reliable source of information about the most important character in all of human history, and that is Jesus Christ and the salvation that comes through him alone. It is certainly a challenge today for us to believe, not because the evidence is not there, it is not because the evidence is not reliable and it is clear, but it is because so many around us don't want to believe it, and they are trying to feed us with the garbage that it is not real, that God is dead and he does not exist. Brethren, nothing could be further from the truth. It may be a challenge to believe only if our hearts are not right with God. The route to faith for someone far removed in time and distance from the things Thomas experienced is necessarily different. We understand that. For example, our proofs for Jesus' resurrection will not necessarily be the exact same ones that Thomas received. We need to be reminded, though, that just because we can't touch Jesus, that no figure in history has had to have that type of evidence that so many other people are requiring. You think about Socrates, or Julius Caesar, Abraham Lincoln, or even Jesus. They are not available for us to touch or to feel or to see or to hear them in some way. All of them have to be authenticated to us indirectly through history or through archaeology or through documents. And when held to the strictest standards of historical evidence, standards that are much higher than the ones that are applied to the ancient pharaohs or to Alexander Great or George Washington. We have more confirmed about the evidence about Jesus' life and history and the resurrection from the dead than practically any other event in human history. And it is on the basis of these many lines of proof, not some blind leap of faith or some irrational sentimentality, that I stake my life now and my destiny for eternity. That based upon the resurrection of Jesus Christ, as Paul says in Romans chapter 1 and verse 4, through the power of the resurrection, he has proved that he is the Son of God. And on the basis of that same evidence, I do not hesitate to invite all others this evening to put your faith in him, to believe his words, to trust in him, and to obey his commandments as we talked about last night. Remember what Jesus said, blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed. What a challenge that is. Brethren, what a meeting we've had this week, not because of the preaching, but because of the word of God. And may we put our trust in that, live by it day by day, that we might come to know him, that we might come to see him, we might come to trust in him, that we might come to obey him and believe in him. And if you believe that this very evening, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, we encourage you to put your faith, your trust in him, and obey him this very evening, repenting of your sins, confessing your faith in Jesus Christ, and having your sins washed away in the waters of baptism. And continue to live a life that is pleasing to God from this point forward, remaining steadfast in the faith. I challenge you from this point forward, brethren, that the people here in Shelbyville stand fast, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. If there's anyone who needs to respond to the Lord's invitation this evening, why don't you come forward now as we stand and as we sing.